Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Tuesday, March 15th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website, click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner. It will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. We encourage people to read that chapter, download the absolutely free PDF file of the worksheet process itself, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And as Jeannie has pointed out through her tireless efforts, that app is continually improving. So if you haven't upgraded it, updated it, downloaded the new version recently, please do that. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one from that webpage that Jeannie has curated out from the last 11 plus years of doing this internet show 5 days a week. In the first 8 years, it was 1 hour a day. In the last 3 years, it's been 2 hours a day. So there are many, many hours of shows. But some of the most relevant for learning how to use the worksheet process have been curated out by Jeannie Rice and put on a list that you'll find on that page. When you go to whyagain.org and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you click on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, etc. So, we are going through the second repetition of Lesson 5 in the Way of Mastery. And yesterday I did a bit of a review of the first four lessons before starting reading the fifth lesson for the second time. And in the time allotted yesterday in the show, we got just through the first two pages of Lesson 5 and the top paragraph of the third page. And essentially what it's saying is, if you do what's suggested in these lessons, in the first four and now the fifth lesson, you will experience yourself differently, your life differently than you ever have before. It's a way of being in the world that your conscious logical mind can't predict and won't have the words to describe. You won't be understandable to your culture, to your family, to the world around you, and you won't even be able to understand it yourself with your conscious logical mind. You will know in the depth of your being that what you're doing is beneficial. You'll feel the benefits. And, you know, as long as your body lasts, you'll still get hungry and feed the body and laugh with friends, and you'll rest and yawn when the body is tired. And yet there will be a level of awareness, a quality of awareness in this work. They're calling it the witness, that is simply watching it all. And that witness is waiting to get input, to be moved by this higher wisdom. Some would call it spirit, some would call it light, some would call it love. In this work, they call it desire, the energy of desire. And though others may not see it, virtually everything you utter will carry the sound of truth, because it won't be coming from your intellectual mind. It will be coming from this connection to your source. The second paragraph on that third page of Lesson 5 reads, "You will not know how spirit will work through you, nor will you care." The reason for that is, when there is no maker or doer or director, it won't matter to you. You're not living from your intellect when you're in this pathway. You're not grasping and you're not pushing away. You're in the allowance state. You're not striving, you're allowing. The text goes on to say, that's what it means to live as the wind. For the wind does not concern itself with where it has been or where it is going. It is moved by some mysterious source that cannot be located at all. Yet it blows, and as it blows, its effect is experience. Imagine then a life in which all that you do is not for yourself. Imagine a way of life in which what you do is not for anyone else. Now, I don't know about you, but I was raised here on the continent of North America in the Midwest, and this sounds crazy because I was indoctrinated, I was educated into a religion, into a family, into a culture where we have heroes and we have villains and we have our personal rights, but we've got responsibilities and allegiances. And this paragraph that says, imagine then a life in which all that you do is not for yourself or for anyone else, sounds like total chaos is going to reign. I have to be there for my family, and I have to fight for my country, and I have to fight for these beliefs, and I have to fight for my religion, and I have to go to church every Sunday, and all of these things that have to be done for my life to have meaning, or for my family to love me and accept me, etc., for my country to be proud of me, etc. So the conscious logical mind should be balking right now, screaming in resistance. Imagine a life in which all that you do, whatever little, whatever massive amounts of things you do, none of it is for yourself, and none of it is for anyone else. Imagine a life in which creativity just flows from a source so deep within you and around you that no language or dogma can contain it. Well, I can't imagine that, because my life, my intellectual processing was formed around language. It was formed within the structure of language. It was formed within the conditioning of the people that taught me right, wrong, good, bad, up, down, left, right. So I can't even imagine a source of creativity flowing from within me that's so deep and it's so widespread around me that language and belief can't contain it. I can't even imagine a force and a source that knows how to express itself through me in such a way that it's constantly and only serving the extension of creation and the awakening, the conscious awakening of all of creation to its unity with its creator. I can't imagine that. But this text is saying, just try to imagine it. Put your conscious logical mind on this task and watch how befuddled it gets. Watch it spin on the hamster wheel. The next paragraph says, the way of the heart does indeed unfold along a certain pathway. And in this lesson, we will address the stages of that pathway in a general sense. And then we will speak of the most important characteristic to be cultivated along this path. The point is, I must find a way to break out of the imprisonment of my identification with my intellectual mind. I must find a way to develop this position of the witness. I must find a way to understand this is not a personal life. I am not all of the thoughts about me and that's it. I am not just the physical body. There is more to my consciousness than just my thoughts about myself and, heaven forbid, somebody else's thoughts about me. This would be easier for me to comprehend or to step into an experience of if I had been introduced to these concepts from childhood, from the initiation of language. But instead, I had, 35 or 45 years of being trained and educated and indoctrinated in the belief that I am just this physical body, and what I do with it is of paramount importance, and I better use it to make money, and I better use it to be in a certain job, and I better, please the people around me and take responsibility for their emotions and their reactions and blame them for my emotions and my reactions. So I've got a lot of unraveling to do. This is not so easy for me to comprehend coming at it as an adult. But I'm being asked in a teaching like this, and there are a number of them out there. A Course in Miracles is very much the same. But I'm being asked to question everything I think I know and to step into a level of allowance that is completely foreign to everything I was trained into in the first, 45 years of my life. It makes me think of the book by Pema Chodron. I believe the title of it is Start Where You Are. And she's talking about Tonglen as a practice. And a form of meditation, and then Tonglen, and then a sense of Start Where You Are is the title of the book. And this Tonglen practice is to sit with and invite the pain that you might be experiencing or that you see somebody else going through. Breathe it in and feel it in your heart space. That's the opposite of everything I was taught to do. That's a level of allowance and surrender to to the flow of life and everything it might stir up in me that I was never even aware was a possibility. As a matter of fact, I was taught the opposite. Whenever I start to feel pain, I should tighten up, tense up, scan the environment, and figure out who or what outside of me is causing that pain, and who or what outside of me I either need to attack or run away from or seduce or bribe to try and get them to change what they're doing so I don't have to feel the pain I'm in. But instead, a book, you know, this Buddhist approach says, hey, breathe into it. Soften when you feel pain instead of tense up. Allow it, study it, let it flow through you. Tap into that part of your experience of life, which they call bodhicitta, or the awakened heart. Your heart, Michael Singer tells us, your heart is capable of playing such musical notes, such the experience of such intense emotions that you have no words for. It's one of the most exquisite, powerful tools, pieces of your being, pieces of creation. The awakened heart, your heart, your emotional center, not the physical heart, but your emotional center, is capable of experiencing and expressing things that go way beyond words each new heartbeat, each new present moment. And you don't get to experience them, you don't get to appreciate them, you don't get to benefit from them when, if they're too intense, you shut down and tighten up and try to push them away. Or when they're very intense or in a positive way, you try to hold on to them and freeze the world and make sure nothing changes because you love this feeling right now. No feeling is meant to last forever. It's a flow of energy. It's an information system. It's the resonance of things I've been holding on to or things I've been through or things that I'm trying to push away. It contains information. And it's something that I could choose to observe from the witness position with delight, with appreciation, with gratitude. And I could even appreciate the intensity of the physical discomfort that comes with various injuries, chronic illnesses, et cetera, rather than try to pretend that what's true isn't true. Guy Finley likes to say that the vast majority of negative emotional experiences, mental and emotional experiences you have in your life comes from trying to pretend that what's true isn't true. And what's not true might someday be true. And the only way through that is stepping into the truth, stepping back into the observer position, stepping into the allowance and surrender, acceptance, trusting. Because as this work has already pointed out in the first four lessons, that's the only way to transcend something, is to accept it, trust it, allow it, breathe into it, surrender to it. So many different deep spiritual paths talk about the very same kind of thing we're talking about here in the first four lessons. And now we're going a little bit deeper into it in the fifth lesson. There are five keys to the kingdom. The text goes on. The first key is desire. First, desire is everything. Without it, not a thing can arise. Therefore, what you desire is of the utmost importance. Here's something that's a recommendation. Desire, then, perfect union with all of creation. Let's say it another way. Desire, then, to be part of the Christ mind incarnate. Let's say it another way. Desire then to be all that your Creator has created you to be, even if you have no idea what that might be or how that might unfold. For when you hold desire within your beingness, and when you have mastered the energy of desire, again, they say real quickly, again, mastery does not mean control. You're not controlling desire. It's the flow of creative energy. You don't get to control that. But with innocence, mastery can arise from innocence. So watching it, being with it, quickly catching any tendency to shut down or resist it, and open to it, this is what they mean by mastery. And grounding it always in the desire to be as you are created to be, then indeed all of your life and all of the subsequent subsidiary desires will come to serve that grand desire. When you come into that state of being, nothing shall be impossible to you. Why? Because you're not the one doing it. You're merely a piece of thread in a very cosmic tapestry being woven by the creator of all creation, that one who alone knows how to weave the tapestry of a new age, a new paradigm, of a healing of this plane and of humanity. So the first stage of the keys to the kingdom is the stage of desire. Only by feeling desire and not suppressing it, by allowing it, by embracing it, by trusting it, only then can you truly begin to move toward the stage of mastery in which the energy of desire always serves that higher will, which is the will of the Creator for you. As we have said to you before, when your will is in alignment with the will of all creation, you will discover that creation's will for you is that you be genuinely happy through and through, that you be content, fulfilled, at peace, empowered, capable, and responsible. This is something the conscious logical mind just cannot wrap itself around. There have been so much training and conditioning for most of us on this planet to strive with the intellectual mind that it is incomprehensible that if I let go of striving with the conscious logical mind and I move into allowing and surrendering and awakening of the heart, that I can tap into that energy and that flow and experience being genuinely happy, being content, being fulfilled, being at peace, being empowered, being capable, and being responsible for my own little domain, my own little dominion in this unfolding process, which is essentially, where do I direct this flow of creation that wants to express through me? Do I direct it towards thoughts of allowance, surrender, gratitude, appreciation, peace, contentment, or do I direct it towards thoughts of resistance, anger, judgment, tension, bitterness, hurt, resentment? That's what I need to be responsible for. I need to step into 100% responsibility for every emotional state I create. I need to step into 100% responsibility for the choice of the focus of my conscious awareness in each new present moment. And when I do that more and more, the quality of my life experience changes exponentially beyond words each new heartbeat. The text goes on to say, the second key is intention. Desire in time is cultivated through intention. For you have used time to teach yourself how to be distracted by all of the thoughts and perceptions that make up this cosmic soup that you call your world. All of you have known the frustration of having a desire, and then as soon as you walk out the door, a friend pulls up and says, hey, let's go to the beach. And you never make it to class, even though your desire was to get the degree. You have cultivated the art of being seduced by distraction. Therefore, it is necessary to utilize time to cultivate intention. For without attention, desire cannot become the crystal clear focus, the laser-like focus that can cut through the dross of this world so that a new creation can flow forth through you. This, again, is something the conscious logical mind will try to grab a hold of and pervert. Oh, I need to put my nose to the grindstone. I need to send, you know, I need to hire 5 coaches so that when one gets tired, the other one steps in and they're right there and they've got the cat of nine tails to whip me in the back or, you know, poke me with the prod and make sure that I never lose my focus. That's what the conscious logical mind would do, and that's not this pathway. This is cultivating a sense of the witness. This is beginning with the desire to stay aligned with the flow of creation, and then using this thing that they are calling intention to cultivate, with the use of time, to cultivate the intention to stay in alignment, to stay in attunement, to stay focused consciously with the awareness of this very gentle, subtle energy that in the entire lesson 4 was giving us some exercises to try and tap into. Intention is not the same as holding a strong egoic or willed commitment to making something happen. For the way of the heart recognizes that you don't know how to do that. You don't know how to get your conscious logical mind to be that focused. For the simple reason that if you did, you would have already accomplished it. So let's be clear about what intention is not, because words fail us in talking about what it is. But this intellectual process of our mind can be used to point out what's false. It may not be able to generate words and language that accurately describe the truth, but it can help us see what's false. Intention is not the same as holding a strong or egoic or willed commitment to making something happen. Rather, it means that you cultivate within your thought process the art of remembering what you're truly here for. Cultivate this. Plant the seed, come back, water it, nurture it, protect it while it grows. You are here to remember that you are the thought of love, the creative energy expressing in form. You are here to remember that you are one with all of creation. You are here to remember that what I have called Abba, though it goes by many names, all that is the source of your only reality. You are living in reality only to the degree that you are consciously aware of the one living through you. Again, I think I mentioned this the last time through. Joseph S. Benner wrote the book The Impersonal Life, and at one point in that book he says, actual thought never arises within a human being until after that human being becomes aware that the divine is living through him or her. that what happens within the mind of a human being prior to that awakening to the divine, the presence, is just intellectual garbage that we were talking about earlier. It's just that mechanical level of mind that Guy Finley talks about. And actual thought only arises within a human mind after the human being is awakened to the presence of the divine mind living in, through, as, and around that individual. So here it says, you're to remember that you're only living in reality to the degree that you are aware that the one, all of creation, God, light, love, Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it, the one is living through you. The text goes on to say, then, therefore, intention in the way of the heart means to utilize time each day to focus your attention on the desire to be Christ incarnate. So what is intention? It means the utilization of time each day to focus your attention on the desire to be Christ incarnate. Text goes on. Intention is that energy or that use of the mind that creates through consistent practice the channel through which desire begins to move down and re-educate the emotional body and even the cellular structure of the physical body and all of the lesser avenues of thinking that occur within the intellect. So that everything involved in your being is integrated, working together, and focused on the fulfillment of that one grand desire, that desire to accept your function in this world. If you question what your function is in this world, they provide some words to help focus you, direct you in that exploration. Your function is healing your sense of separation from the rest of creation, from God, from light, from love, from every other person around you. Healing your sense of separation is your one true purpose. Waking up to the truth of life is your one true purpose. Finding a way to be of service to the atonement, the at-one-ment, is your one true purpose. So how do you apply intention? Here's a suggestion. Each day, just as you have used time to teach yourself to be easily distracted, you need only ask yourself one question daily. Here's the question. What is it that I most desire? From that calm, centered space, allowing my breath to move more deeply and rhythmically, opening to the more subtle energies, putting the conscious logical mind aside for now, gently repeating, what is it that I most desire? I might also ask, what am I doing on this planet? I might also ask, what am I committed to? These last two questions are just forms of the fundamental question, what is it that the energy of creation would like to express uniquely through me in this next present moment? The text goes on. As you keep practicing asking that question, the answer will become clearer and clearer. Not with your conscious logical mind, in your heart space, in your bodhicitta, in your awakened heart, in your very open, gentle, loving center. As you keep practicing and asking that question, the answer will become clearer and clearer, for it is the question that influences, stimulates, and gives birth to the answer. The universe is always answering your questions. And when you ask unclear questions, you get unclear answers. So this work suggests that you become crystal clear with your intention and remind yourself of it daily. Here's a suggestion. You might want to use this or make up your own to be more clear. But in quotes, My intention is to use time constructively for the relearning of what it means to abide in the kingdom of heaven and to fulfill my function. My function is healing, and healing requires the presence of the Christ mind, for only the Christ mind can express the capital L love that brings healing into being. The text goes on to say, desire and intention are critical. These stages unfold in the field of time as one matures in the pathway of the heart. So this might be one of the most important lines for my intellectual mind to hear. These stages of desire and intention are critical, and they unfold in the field of time as one matures in the way of the heart. This isn't speak a word and you become what you spoke. This isn't one time through, oh, I think I know what they mean by that. Got it. And now I'm done. Because as Dr. Michael Rice would point out over and over again, the word only contains the meaning that it resonates within the brain cells of whoever hears the word. The word itself is meaningless. The word has no meaning until it's heard by a person as vibrations in the air that strike the eardrum, that send a signal to the brain, that resonate content in that brain, and all of a sudden, here's an image, here's a thought, here's an action. But the meaning of the word, especially something like the way of the heart, that steps outside the intellect, outside the language, outside what is known by the intellect, is something I must cultivate and mature into. I cannot possibly know what it would be like to put aside the intellect, to quit making the intellect my God, and to have the intellect there as a tool that serves very, very faithfully my awakened heart, and that I live moment to moment from the awakened heart and from the energy of creation that's trying to express through me in the moment. I can't know anything about what that means when I first hear this. I must let it unfold in the field of time as I practice and cultivate the steps that would put me into the pathway of the way of the heart. So, again, every thought of beating myself up because I missed a day or two of practice, or I missed an hour or two where I didn't wake up for 5 minutes to realize that I'm creating whatever I'm experiencing, every negative thought I hold is part of the dream of separation. It's an error. It's an illusion. It's a resistance to the flow of life, whatever that is. And this is known across a variety of different deep spiritual traditions, which is why that practice of Tonglen has me breathing in the pain, letting it be there fully, breathing in my own pain, softening to it, studying it, allowing it, rather than pushing it away. Watching the suffering that I see of other people and breathing into that very specifically, not a general, oh, the suffering of all people I take into myself, but the specifics that I'm consciously aware of that might resonate my own painful experience. And I breathe it in and I welcome it and I breathe out the love. I breathe out the light. I'm moving into an experience that my conscious logical mind can't rationalize at any level. Why in the heck would you bring pain into you? Why would you welcome pain? It doesn't make any sense to the intellectual mind. So we need, if we want to achieve this, we're going to have to allow it to unfold. And page 60, middle of the page, desire and intention, the first two keys to the kingdom, they are critical. And these stages don't happen at the snap of a finger. They unfold in the field of time as an individual matures in the way of the heart, as an individual chooses the focus of his or her conscious awareness in each new present moment and takes 100% responsibility for the experience of life they create in that moment. They choose to use the tool of forgiveness, which is to dismantle any negative perception, any perception they generate which results in a negative emotion, or the judgment of another, or the judgment of themselves, understanding that judgment is a poison, and judgment will take you to the other end of the universe from where you say you want to be, and that we will judge because we've been conditioned to judge, and that's okay. Guy Finley says in one of his talks, I'm a wreck. Then he invites the audience to say it, I'm a wreck, and it's okay. We're all a wreck. We've all been conditioned to this counterproductive pattern of thought and judgment and resistance. Allowing myself to see that, stepping into the position of the witness and the observer, opening myself and questioning and allowing, puts me into this pathway within the field of time and allows this to unfold. These stages unfold, and I start to have a different experience. As I have a different experience, I become aware that I'm more than just the physical body. As I step into that awareness, I have an experience of myself and the world around me that goes beyond words each new heartbeat. And then when I reread this lesson, it impacts me at an entirely different level. So desire and intention are critical, and they are stages that unfold in the field of time as one matures in the way of the heart, as one practices, as one cultivates. Practice what? Practice being with your breath. Practice noticing any tightness or tension. Practice becoming aware that any tightness or tension within the physical body is your alarm system of the fact that you have mental emotional resistance, that you're trying to deny the truth of what is, that you're trying to assume that your conscious logical mind knows better how the world is supposed to be unfolding than the world itself does. And that is hubris. That is unweaning arrogance. That is the child thinking that he or she is better, grander than all of the universe. So we're in the middle of page 60 in the fifth lesson. And it says, the third key is allowance. Here's another mind bender. Here's another layers of depth for redefining a word that we can step into if we're willing to practice what's suggested. Not just read and talk and think about the words, but actually live your life moment to moment in a different way. The text says, the third stage of the process whereby the mind is wholly and completely corrected, and that process by which one returns home, which would mean conscious connection to the truth of life, actuality, as Michael Rice calls it. The text reads, for the egoic world does not teach you how to allow, it teaches you to strive. The egoic world says you must be the maker and the doer. You must find a way to manipulate or control your environment in order that it conform itself to the image that you're holding in your mind. Now, all of that's well and good, and there have been many beings that learn with some valuable lessons through that process, that by following the path of certain teachers that will teach you that you can create whatever you want, that will seem like such a big deal right up until the moment that you realize that this is what you've been doing all the time, every moment of life. You are always creating exactly what you decree. It is no big deal, and it is not a secret. But there will be those that will teach you, and they'll say, well, we'll just go into your mind and we'll ask yourself what you want, and then when you see that picture of the Mercedes, then we'll simply do all of these little magical tricks, and pretty soon you end up with a Mercedes. The book points out that the problem with that is that your intellect, that worldly part of your mind that's been stuffed full of garbage like a garbage can, and it can only chew on and reiterate what's been poured into it, that part of your mind can only desire what it has been programmed to desire. It can be useful to learn from some of these teachers that teach the secret or the law of attraction, or that process, that little class you might take, that little series of exercises you do, can be useful to wake you up to the fact that the power of your mind is incredible, but the power of your awakened heart is infinite. And the process of creating your experience of life in each new present moment is what you've been involved in ever since you became a corporal body, ever since you incarnated. It's what you've been doing all the time. And the worldly part of your mind says, well, I have to transport my body around this plane, and automobiles do that. And as I look around, the world tells me that a Mercedes is a grand way of doing that. So therefore, I will create the desire of wanting a Mercedes. And then when you manifest the Mercedes, you fool yourself into thinking that you have made great progress, when in fact, all you've done is what you have always done. You have chosen what your experience will be, and you have manifested it. There is nothing new about that, although by doing so, you can begin to regain confidence in your ability to manifest. And unless you have a text like this, a teacher like this, a pathway like this that points out to you that it's a trap to think that the most important thing is your physical body and your physical world, and that's all that matters, because then you can only manifest what you've been programmed to desire and manifest. Guy Finley, in one of his talks about manifesting and desiring, he says, listen, this is so much of a trap, and people don't want you to know it's a trap because they want you to take their course and they want you to, you know, follow them. And but he says, I will give you something better to manifest. And then he says, I know what your mind is saying. I'm telling you that manifesting stuff is bad, and then I'm telling you, here's something to manifest, but I will give you something far better to manifest than the new house or the better relationship or the Mercedes-Benz or whatever. He says, manifest a way to be happy, content, at peace with whatever you have already in this moment. This goes right back to what the first four lessons were telling us. The peace that we're being offered through this pathway is a peace that we can step into even when the building is crumbling around us and the bank account is full of zeros. Manifest that. manifest your awake, aware, bodhicitta, open heart, soft, sensitive, raw, intense awareness that you can tolerate, and even learn to appreciate everything that flows in life. When you do that, now you've got something worth manifesting. Abraham Hicks says, look, the problem with manifesting a car before you understand this process is that you don't really want the car. Huh? I thought that's all I can think about is that Ferrari or that Tesla or that Mercedes or that name your, you know, delightful car of choice. Abraham says, what you want is the feeling you believe you're going to have once you achieve, once you attain, what you accrue this thing. And so then Guy Finley points out, this is such a trap because the minute I spend all that money, that all that time accumulating that money, saving that money, get the money for the car, get the car, the minute I have it and I have that rush of joy, now I have fear come up. Uh-oh, what if I lose it? And he says, let's question this. How in heaven's name can the source of my joy be in that same moment the source of my fear? Awakening to that impossibility is a wonderful awakening. And then I start to realize, oh, wait a minute, this thing that I just acquired is not creating my joy. I'm creating my joy. And Abraham Hicks would say, go out, find a way to manifest that feeling, feel good in, through, as, and about yourself in each new present moment. And then if you want a car, go get a car. Because now you'll have that feeling of contentment, of joy, of peace, and you know it's not dependent upon whether the car stays in pristine condition or gets repossessed or stolen. The essence of this work is so much like so many others. Learn to tune your mind, your open heart, to awareness of your true nature and your connection to all of life and the flow of creation itself, and choose the intention to cultivate that awareness more and more each day. But the way of the heart is not about manifesting physical material things. The way of the heart is about something else. Allowance in this pathway means that you begin to view your life very differently. Allowance in this pathway means you don't view your life as a struggle to get out of school and create a career by which you can create golden coins, by which you can create the proper house and the proper environment so that your ego feels successful. And therefore, you feel like you're worthy of being loved. That's not what this is about. The way of the heart begins with the recognition that you already are loved by the only source that matters. You are being infused with the energy of creation that gave rise to you, that some would call love. You are that energy of love, and the purpose of extending that in the world is what fulfills you. You've come for the purpose that can be made manifest in the ways of the world, but is not of the world. What is that? Extending the energy of creation, of light, of love, to yourself and everyone around you in each new present moment. Here's a highlight paragraph for me in this lesson. Allowance is the cultivation of a way of looking at the events in your life not as obstacles to getting what you want, but looking at the events in your life as stepping stones to getting what you truly want. Each event in your life presents you with a blessing, of the lessons required to heal any obstacles to the presence of love, to your conscious awareness of the presence of love as the source and the ground of your being, to awaken to your true nature as the extension of the creative energy in form, as the extension of life, the extension of love in form. That's what this pathway is about. And allowance is the cultivation of a way of looking at the events of your life in such a way that they are the stepping stones to help you move into this conscious awareness of the presence of life, of love, of creation as the source and ground of your being, and to awaken you into the awareness that in each new present moment, you could choose to ask of that source, how can I be a blessing to myself and others in this moment? What's mine to do here to extend the loving energy that gave rise to me and is expressing in, through, as, and around me in the world in this moment? That's what can happen in this pathway if I allow it to unfold over time with my using my mind energy, with aligning with the presence of the energy of desire that wants to express uniquely through me in each moment, holding my intention to stay aligned with that by asking questions like, why am I here? What do I truly desire? What's the best way I can serve the atonement and my brother and sister in this moment? And then allowing whatever unfolds and choosing to see what happens as events unfold in my life as the stepping stones to the very vertical pathway to the heart of creation. So that's what we're here to support people in doing. I'm grateful to everyone who's choosing to listen in today. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, the energy of creation expressing in form, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice. Hopefully, I'm turning on your microphone.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I had to unmute there. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, March the 15th, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And we'll give Michael just a minute to get dialed in, and I'll invite you to go to the website, which is whyagain.org, whyagain.org. Click on the Start Here button. Or you can scroll down to the bullseye in the middle of the page. And both of those take you to the same place. And we've made some changes on the website. Actually, from the homepage, from whyagain.org, there is the big button for taking you straight to the Reality Management Forgiveness Worksheets, the wake-up sheets. Then there's another big button, and it's all of the rest of the tools, all the other worksheets. So you can click there, or you can go to the Start Here or the Bullseye. And the first thing you'll see is the factors that create perception, the poster. And then it says, if you're new to the tools, read this first, and you'll know exactly how to proceed in the most beneficial way to use the Forgiveness Reality Management wake-up sheets from Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And so the very first link underneath that poster is to chapter 24 of Michael's book, where Michael walks the character Richard through the forgiveness process, PowerPoint presentation of Aramaic forgiveness. And then the third link down is the Reality Management wake-up sheets, many versions of it. There's also some adaptations by other teachers that's there. Then there's the MP3s of special radio shows where we've walked people through doing the forgiveness work. All the other worksheets, there's the link for the information to the app and wake-up sheets that can be completed online. Then there's a section on addiction. So there's lots of new sections added to that. So if you click the start here or the bullseye, it'll take you to that page, and you'll be able to scroll down through there and just, you know, put it to use, make yourself familiar with what's out there. Under the schedule button on the website, we have the information for the Global Online Book Club. If you want to be a part of that, the young lady is over in England, I believe, and she's been doing this book club. It's called Hear My Voice, and she's been doing it for many years, and it actually turns out that each meeting is not just discussing the book, but it's almost like workshops. And so she had asked Michael to participate in the one on March the 3rd, and we did, and had a very warm welcoming, had probably 40 people, I don't know, on there. It's done by Zoom. So they've asked us to be back with it, and that is going to be on the 24th and the 31st at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And so the Zoom link and everything is on that page. If you click under schedule, you'll see Global Online Book Club. And so you can join us with that. So Michael will be going over the first week. She wants him to go over the worksheet. And then the second week, she wants him to be open for questions and answers. So that will be very interesting, and come be a part of that. There's people from many, many countries. And so it's awesome to make new friends on the other side of the world. And, you know, hopefully we can together create the critical mass and change some of the craziness that's going on in the world right now. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. I'm certainly with you in shifting the craziness that's going on in the world. And, of course, to do that, we need to recognize that we're part of the world. And as we shift our own craziness, we can start to shift the craziness of the world. Of course, doing the same old stuff over and over again, lazy and just playing out whatever's in the mind, never putting the energy into doing the work that it takes to change it, while insisting everybody else does the work. It's kind of silly. I love two things that Mahatma Gandhi said. First of all, he said, if you want potatoes, you got to use the hoe. You got to put that thing to work. And two, be the change you want to see in the world. If you want that war to stop over there, are you at war with anyone? Yourself, the person, pardon me, excuse me, the person you look at in the mirror? Or the person you lay down in bed with at night? Or the child that you awaken in the morning? Or the neighbor? Or the friend? What if we got to the point in our lives it was impossible to offend us? What would that be like? What would a mind be like that was impossible to offend? And guess what? It's not possible to offend anybody's mind. That's already true. Your mind is absolutely impossible to offend. Unless there's offense in it, then pretty much anything will do. We tend to live in this state of denial. Remember our definition of denial: when I think or speak, though something outside of me is the cause of what's moving inside of me, I'm in denial. And when I do that, I dissociate from a part of my mind. I have to hide a part of my mind. What does that look like? You offended me. I find that really offensive. It's called denial. And when you live there, the part of your mind that needs to be changed in order to you for you to be free of offenses is now hidden from you, inaccessible, and you're unable to change it. When I step into responsibility, wow. When that happened, it really brought up offense in me. Just a slight shift in language. Now, if you recognize that the human mind is a purely evidential device, what does that mean? Well, there's some great Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, that is, there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity happening in the brain. In that same time frame, the amount of evidence or the amount of information that goes into building your perceptual construct in that time frame is 9 bits. When you're looking at only 9 bits of data out of 10,000, you're only looking at evidence. And you only get to see the evidence that your mind is given permission to show you. If you are totally prejudiced against some circumstance, then even if there is no evidence to support your prejudice, your mind will fire that information called for by the goal to prove that someone else is the problem in your life. And you will hallucinate a literal perceptual construct, a picture world that will show you the lie that somebody else is the problem in your life. So that's the evidential mind. The only thing you ever get to see from an evidential mind is the BS of that evidential mind. And that's, of course, belief system. If you have a different reality for those initials, I invite you to notice that that's what's in your evidential mind. That's the evidence your mind has for the initials BS, but not the evidence my mind has. And so this evidential mind is constantly constructing a world based upon what it's been instructed to do. So instruction equals construction. Brain, show me the evidence that somebody else is the problem in my life, and I will be limited to that evidence. It may be totally, completely fraudulent, a lie, hallucination, but I will believe it because I don't know how to operate my own mind. If you engage and if you find yourself, quote unquote, easily offended, it's because there is a very powerful energetic pattern of offense within your mind. And if you want to get rid of that, the way to do it is to engage in the first century Aramaic forgiveness process. Remembering that the word forgive doesn't mean I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. That's a Greek silliness. In the ancient Aramaic world, you'd never be invited to forgive another. You'd never be invited to forgive yourself. But if you were in offense and you wanted to be free of your offense, you would be instructed to apply forgiveness to the offense in your mind to weaken or remove it from your mind. For many people, that's probably going to take 77 times 70 worksheets. It's going to take some work. But as you do it, the person shows up that yesterday could just turn their head the right way and offend you, quote unquote, your mind would believe they offended you. But once you remove offense, what you'll observe is that person simply turning their head. You won't observe someone offending you. If you say there are people who enrage you, start to apply forgiveness to your rage, and you won't be able to rage again. That circumstance makes me sad. Apply forgiveness to your sadness and remove the capacity for sadness from your mind. Well, but Michael, certain things happen, and of course you have to be sad. Who says you have to be sad? Who gave you that instruction? Somebody had a BS and fed that BS to you. And if you bought it, then you'll think that's what you have to do. Oh, but Michael, someone died. Of course I'm going to be distraught and grief-stricken. Well, here's my offering. If someone in your life dies, cancel the thought. You will never be distraught or grief-stricken because they died. You'll be distraught and grief-stricken because there's that energy of being distraught and grief-stricken in your mind. You start to apply forgiveness to those energetic patterns, and they're gone. And no longer do circumstances seem to dictate the perceptual structures that your mind presents to you. You enter into a whole new world, a world of choice. And when I realize that this mind of mine is designed to be fueled by active present love, then each time something happens in my world, I bring the fuel of love to that circumstance. And believe me, there's nothing more transforming than that. If you remember that line in the Forgiveness Reality Management Worksheet, it says, when I choose love, it wakes up the love in everyone. Literally, love is an energy. It's who you are. And if you are literally present in your own body and in your own life, and events happen that people say are terrible and awful and sad and cause rage, if you bring love to that circumstance, then you become the space that can open the healing in the person who is grief-stricken or traumatized. Because when grief, trauma, rage, sadness, hatred, vengeance, and fear are exposed to conscious, active, present love, those energetic patterns begin to dissolve. So in the presence of love, truth becomes apparent. And hostility and fear brought to the presence of active love begin to heal. You know, if I have a middle C tuning fork and I hit it hard on a desk and I put it in front of a second middle C tuning fork, can that second middle C tuning fork say, I'm not going to vibrate in response to that middle C? I don't like that middle C. I'm not going to do it. Does the tuning fork have that choice? No. It's just a pure energy dynamic. One middle C tuning fork starts to vibrate, and there's another one present, and the second middle C tuning fork begins to vibrate. No choice about it. When we recognize that each and every one of us is the active presence of love, and instead of running away from circumstances, we choose to and we aim to and we set goals to bring love to that circumstance, then what starts to happen is love that perhaps has never, or perhaps in many decades in a particular individual, never been present, because their mind has been so filled with rage and fear, all of a sudden, by you being, so to speak, the tuning fork, that base of active present love, you resonate, and that other individual has no choice, you resonate that active presence of love in them, and it starts to move. It has to. Now, that doesn't mean the first time you do it, there's going to be this giant breakthrough, and they're going to go, oh, look at this, I am love. But the conscious, consistent, persistent effort, this is one of the reasons why we need to get our definitions of words correct. You know, we've asked the question many times, have you ever held a newborn? And we invite you to go back to the moment where you held a newborn. And of the tens of thousands of people we've asked that question of, when they tell us what the essence of the newborn is, the word they use is always some variation on the theme of love. And then when I say, is the newborn loving you or is the newborn love? Everybody stops, kind of cocks their head and thinks about it and says, well, clearly the newborn is love. So if you is love, if that's what you are, and you hold that present, if you understand the meaning of the word rather than what the world is specialized in, and basically we all come into the world exactly the same way as conscious, active, present love, and the specialty of the world has become the knocking of that presence of love out of us, the knocking of the awareness of ourselves as love out of us. And then they give us a fake instruction that distracts people all their lives. And the instruction is, now go out the door and find somebody to love. Go out the door and find somebody to love you. And now a false journey begins. And when people have matching bags of garbage, they quote unquote say, ah, we've fallen in love. And then, predictably, when the honeymoon is over, when one gives up the false belief that, oh, I've finally found someone that's going to alleviate me of the burden of looking at the pain that's inside of me, the pain that's inside of me starts to move in the presence of that perfect person, and if I hook my pain up to my brain's image of them, all of a sudden, they become the cause of my pain, and the honeymoon is over. Falling in love is a myth. It's all a lie. It's all based on a fraud. You can't fall in love. You've never been loved. You'll never be loved. And nobody will ever, ever love you. And you will never love anyone else. That's all a fraud. Love is not a verb. It's not something we do. It's what we are. If you keep trying to do love, if you keep instructing your mind in the goals of trying to do love, do love, do love, do love, and someone comes along with a tuning fork for rage and you've got rage in you, guess what you're going to do? You're going to do rage because that's what's in you. And then you'll be, because you were told to love them, a fraud, then you'll probably have guilt for not loving them, but instead having rage toward them. Oh, you may shut your mouth. You may hold your breath. You may simmer in that rage so it doesn't show. But once again, we've been set up for failure. Let go of the need. Let go of the belief you could ever love anyone. Love is not what we do. But when you set the goal to bring forward conscious, active, present love in every moment of your life, to bring your true essence, your true being into action and activity in your life, in your relationships, in your business world, in your financial world, in your sexual world, when you bring love forward, by so doing, you begin to resonate or activate the presence of that very energy in everyone that you touch. That's what our world needs. When they said what the world needs, how that song, what the world needs now is love, sweet love, they're not talking about doing love. They're talking about we need beings who understand who they are and bring love present to every circumstance they encounter, including those that bring up rage and hatred and vengeance. And when we do that, the rage and hatred and vengeance, by the simple exposure to active present love, begins to dissolve, and we and the world are alleviated of the burden of that pain. There is no other method that I know of with which you can consistently and persistently achieve that goal besides forgiveness. I mean, every tool that we teach is to augment that, but the core of it is to apply the tool of forgiveness to shave off the hate, the fear, the rage, the guilt, the grief, the pain. You're only experiencing those things because they are in you and they need to be removed. And the removal tool is forgiveness. And notice how the world's turned it all backward. And I believe that if I just forgive you, then everything in my life is going to be okay. If you would just forgive me, if God would just forgive us, guess what? God's never going to forgive us any more than God's ever going to love us. Because God is love. God doesn't do love. And forgiveness is about removal of what doesn't belong. It's not about being let off the hook for your offenses. We've got to shift this whole mental construct around and begin to understand things based in truth. You know, Vladimir Lenin is probably responsible for more deaths on planet Earth than any human being in all of history. And here's what he brilliantly said. If you want to destroy a culture, change the meaning of its words. You notice what's happening in the world today. We've got an invasion and a war going on, but in the country that's doing it, the words invasion and war have been outlawed. In fact, they put people in prison for using those words to describe what's being done. No, no. This is an operation to rescue our fellow countrymen. And now you've changed the meaning of the words, and the world is insane. Please. Never forgive anyone for anything. Forgive continuously, but never forgive anyone for anything. Love continuously, but never love yourself or another, because it can't be done. And that tends to bring such confusion to people, because we've been given false definitions of words, and people go, oh, well, that's just semantics. No, it's not. It's the rules by which we govern our minds and our lives. And if we don't know, go back to Plato. Plato said, let me define the word and I will end the argument. He understood the meaning and the power of words in the human realm. So the application of forgiveness is what removes those energetic patterns that the Greeks call sin. And remember, the word sin is simply an archery term that means off the mark. If you were on the archery range and fired at the bullseye and you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper would yell sin. That's all it means. So yes, I want to apply forgiveness to my sin. To any energy that I hold that's off the mark, I want to apply forgiveness in order to remove it. People go around the world, around the country with bumper stickers on their car that say, I've been forgiven. Like, now see, I can do anything because I've been forgiven. I said some magic words and then the Creator let me off the hook and now I can do just about anything. When you utilize words that truly means something different than what you've been taught, than what you've been brainwashed into, then the conversations that come out of those words are just pure, plain silliness. You go back to Yeshua in the Aramaic language, he never said, love your neighbor. He never said, love God. He never said, love as you love yourself. That is not what is in those Aramaic texts. When they said to him, what's most important in the law? And this word is key importance. It is the primo word that needs to be understood. And guess what? You can't even say it in English or Latin or Greek. There are no words to even approximate what he said 2,000 years ago in the Aramaic language. It takes a paragraph to begin to describe the meaning of that word, rachma. He didn't say love your neighbor. He said have rachma for your neighbor. He didn't say love the Creator. He said have rachma for the Creator. He didn't say love yourself. He said have rachma for yourself. And rachma, it turns out, it's a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that is the gateway through which your true being love passes and enters into your human form. In essence, what they said to him was, well, what is it we need to do in order to be truly human? He said, you've got to have the gateway open that allows your created essence, love, your newbornness, to come into your physiology. And then when that gateway is open, because it also is a gateway over the frontal lobes of the brain where intentions are stored, all of your intentions will be on track. I mean, the genius, the understanding of this and how the mind operates. And those who don't want to know, don't want to take responsibility, and like to do their hostility and fear practices will say things like, oh, those old fogies in the desert didn't know anything 2,000 years ago. Well, if they only had a clue. So rachma allows love to be present in your physiology, in your mind. It's not an emotion. It's a state of being. And when that gateway is open, then all of your intentions, because it also acts as a filter, will be keyed to love instead of hostility and fear. Instead of negative and destructive intentions, you'll have intentions that are keyed to love. Intentions that come from the true state of being that you are. Now your perceptual mind will be on track with love. And it takes time to even build the brain cells to understand, to comprehend what that means. But once you know what the word actually means, then you can begin to follow the instruction to keep that gateway open, to keep love present in you. And now you've got the key to all healing. And that's what we are here to support. And we're glad you're here to lend us a set of ears to talk to about it. And so, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up? Anything happening in the chat room? Do you have your mute button on, sweetie? Hello, Jeannie.
Okay. I had to dial back in a while ago. I got bumped off. But, I said everybody's in resonance today because someone in the chat room, he's actually new. I think Friday was his first day on the show. And he asked two questions, and I said, well, hold until Michael quits his monologue. And I said, I'll ask him the questions. But in your monologue, you answered both questions. And
sweet.
One was to explain your definition of love and to explain your definition of forgiveness, and you did both of those. So,
oh, cool.
I said, everybody is rock and rolling right together, and we do have a hand up.
Cool. And if there are any refinements needed, any other questions, because they're really subtle word changes and idea changes, please call in and ask or type your question in, and let's continue the conversation. Let's speak to our caller.
And they said that they had never held a newborn when you were doing that explanation. And I said, well, think about holding a new kitten or a new puppy, because what we're actually talking about is that innocent newborn life. And he said, oh, he had held many, many puppies. So he got it. So our caller is 610. I believe it's Miss Susan. Welcome.
Hi. Long time no
talk.
Well,
hi there, young lady. Good to hear your voice. I've been wondering where you've been lately.
Well, I've been on. I have so many questions, Michael. That's how it goes. I don't even know where to begin.
Oh, good, good.
Let
good,
me begin
good.
With some, something simple. I was reading a comment by Corinne Zupko. I don't know if you know who she is, but she's a student of A Course in Miracles, has been for years, written a book called From
right.
Anxiety to Love, and Tim Hayes actually interviewed her some time ago. She wrote
right.
a recent comment about the difference between guidance and intuition. And she said her take is that guidance comes from spirit, that it's God's word to you. And intuition is what we intuit among ourselves. Like if somebody comes into a room and they seem very sad, and your intuition may say, this person seems sad. And I know you say there's no such thing as you've got sadness in you if you recognize sadness. I don't think that's quite what you meant. So I would love clarification on all of those little deals.
Okay. Well, here would be my take. I couldn't recognize sadness if I don't have the brain cells for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
there are two states that I could be in having the brain cells. In order to have the brain cells,
okay.
I've been sad. So I could recognize sadness in someone else because I have those brain cells. And
that makes sense.
I can recognize it from the point of view where I've worked it out, and I can look at them with compassion and hold a space of love and help them to process their sadness. Or I can see them from a place of I have not touched or resolved my own sadness, so here I am. I'm going to get down in the pit and cry with you and share our sadness. I'm going to, you know, walk into a sympathetic state with you. So I can experience it from one of two sides. I can only, you know, if I don't have the brain cells, I can't even see that it's there. You know, you've heard me talk before about the
right.
the explorers on the coast of South America, and they you
right.
know, anchor their tall ships right off the beach.
And,
yeah,
right.
and they go in, and after they communicate with the natives finally figure out how to communicate, like, where did you come from? You just appeared in that little boat in the water, and they point to the tall ship, and the natives could not see it. The brain could not formulate a picture to match or give them any idea that ship was even there. And the only way
wow.
we can start to comprehend anything, and much of what we think we comprehend is what we hold in brain cells about what we're observing or think we're observing, and it's totally and completely off base for what is actually there. So we're all living in our own perceptual constructs, and if I work through my sadness, then I'm going to be able to bring love present and create support for the healing of this sadness rather than, you know, getting down in the pit and suffering. You know, I like to think about, okay, cool.
That makes sense.
Does that adequately address that idea?
Yeah. What did you just say, Michael? I don't want to misunderstand. What did you just say?
Well, I was going to add another thought.
Okay.
Thought that I was going to add is, so I go into a funeral home where I have a dear friend who's lost someone, and they're in great
yeah.
grief and sadness.
Right.
Am I of more service to them by going in with my unresolved grief and sadness and boo-hooing with them? Or am I really serving them and perhaps the deceased as well if I can walk in my essence as active present love, support them processing through their thought disorders of loss and grief, and perhaps hold the space of love for the person who's just left their body for whatever their journey is about? In which position am
mm-hmm.
I of most benefit?
Right. It's pretty obvious when you put it that way. Yeah. So
now, as far as the guidance versus intuition,
mm-hmm.
For me, that distinction isn't there. I hear it. I understand it, but I'm not sure I agree with it. I would see
okay.
that the guidance that comes to me comes through, you know, it doesn't come through my normal sensory channels, but it comes from that spiritual faculty of intuition. So if I'm listening to Rukka, it's going to come through that channel, although it can come in other ways as well. I'm actually doing a presentation tonight for practitioners who are using the Avicen, and one of the examples mm-hmm. I'm going to use with them is that, you know, I've done workshops on intuitive development, and in the intuitive development workshop, one of the things we work with is getting people to the point where they experience information differently than through the sensory apparatus that they normally use. So instead of experiencing, let's say, someone who's really in a sweet, loving space as a smile, I might experience them as the color of a rose. So it might be a color that communicates to me their state of being.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a symbol that communicates with me. It might be a sensation. So there are many ways we can receive information through that intuitive faculty. And to me, it's that intuitive faculty in which I receive guidance. And that guidance is not from my senses or my brain cell structure. It's coming through that intuition. So, and I'm not saying that her assessment of that is incorrect. I'm just saying that's not how I experience it, but she may be right on track
yeah.
for her experience.
Well, I have a hard time with the word guidance because it sort of it's like the last word. If I had an aunt who once came to me and said, I had guidance to do, and I forget what she had guidance to, but for me it felt entirely wrong. But she said, I had guidance, which trumped my experience totally. It wiped it right out. So I don't like word.
I hear you loud and clear. I've seen that happen many times over the years. We'll get somebody, you know, at Heartland, we do in the summers. Unfortunately, we're not operating right now, but in the summers, what we normally do is we have a support team project where people will come and be on the support team for the summer, and that'll be a kind of a work exchange. And somebody comes who's, I heard about this great work, and boy, I want to do this. This really sounds like fun. And then they find that what they need to do is face their rage and their grief and maybe their hatred and vengeance. And all of a sudden, when that stuff starts to move, you know, they started out with they were guided to come and be on the support team. But 2 weeks later, when that ugly stuff starts to move, their guidance all of a sudden is, oh, what I really need to do is go on and head off to, you know, another country or somewhere where I don't have to deal with myself. It's like I've seen that many, many times. So I understand exactly what you're saying there.
Okay, good. That helps a lot. And I've had a friend who uses the word intuition on me the same way. She'll say, I'm very intuitive, and I'm picking up that you're this, that, and the other. And I'll say, whoa, okay, well, it's usually something not very flattering. So I said, well, gosh, you know, can you want to do something? Because she immediately clears them. She said, you want me to clear it? And I say, well, definitely. If those entities are hanging around, please wipe them out. But the whole thing flummoxes me. I just sit there and think, well, I do have an awful lot of rage, and I have a lot of sadness, and I have a lot of resistance. And so you may be right, but feel a little, I don't like it. That's what it is. I don't like it when she does that. So,
well, my offering, if you listen to the show over the years as you have, you'll notice that oftentimes I get a sense of something going on for somebody. But for me, what I know is first and foremost, if that's my sense of it, that energy's about me, and it may or may not be true about them. So to me, as opposed to presenting as, well, I have the superior attitude, and here's what's wrong with you. It's like, well, you know, the sense I'm getting is that maybe thus and so is true. Does that fit for you? And that leaves room for, instead of playing the game of the superior. It's like, you know, that's what I get, and I'm willing to be totally and completely in error. How's that feel for you? And that changes everything.
That helps a lot.
Jensen's dad and Leticia are now divorced, and this is their first separate Christmas.
This year is her first Christmas technically alone. Her and my dad were doing it.
Excuse me.
That isn't from my house.
What is that?
Yeah, I don't know what
that is. I've been doing some research, and I accidentally hit the button on the TV, and it started, and it won't shut off. There, I finally got to be quiet.
Good. Good. I'm glad it's you that did it, Michael.
It intuitively kicked in and started to make noise.
Right. It had guidance. Right.
Yeah, there you go.
So I've been listening very closely to your thing about the reunion in 49-49, and I'm one of the people I'm sure you refer to when you say there are people who say they don't live that long, and there are people who resist this idea. I think I understand what you're talking about. I don't feel, and this is not a good thought to have, but I don't feel as if, see, I'm 78 and I still have a lot of stuff that needs the worksheets, and I'm doing them. I am doing, it's like it doesn't stop almost. You know, and when I'm walking around, of course, it's in my head, but it's like Dietrich Walzak. He says, I assess my feeling because that pops up, and then I know it's about me. So then I have to do the work. Those are the first two steps. I feel my feeling.
Right.
I know it's off the mark. So I start doing my work. And the more I do, the more I need to do. And it seems as if to clear those, now this is where I might not understand you, but to clear things to that point where I could outlive what looks like a ticking clock seems impossible to me. I'm doing my best, but it just seems as if that can't happen. And in accompaniment with that, I was with the refugee children this morning. We were short-staffed. We were running after seven little tiny people. And I was playing Thomas the Tank Engine with one and doing all these other things. And I was, even though I do my exercise and I was feeling my age. I wasn't as rubbery. I got tired and I thought, there it is. I got to ask Michael about this. How do we, it just seems, when you talk about that, I end up feeling hopeless and ashamed that I can't think that I could join.
That's awesome. Wow. Now you get to heal. Now you get to forgive hopelessness and shame. Just like you were saying about that other fellow, well, now I'm feeling this. Now I know it's my work. So what if when I feel shame, I go, here's my chance to forgive shame, this load, this burden that loads me down. And here's my chance to forgive hopelessness. Now, if you look back at your generations, how did hopelessness and shame fit into your generational family system?
Oh, I could look at that. I can't answer that right now off the top of my head. We were a pretty plucky bunch.
Well, let me ask a different question. You started doing this work, what? It's probably getting on to 4 years ago now?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
If you did a self-assessment, and I'm not asking you to answer this question on the show, but just in your own mind, 4 years ago when the stress was up and the chips are down, as they tend to happen for all of us from time to time, on a scale of 1 to 100, what would be your level of disturbance or upset? And I'm going to plug in a number and say, well, you know, as I'm just talking about myself and I've got all this work to do and I carry all this anger and da-da, I was probably at an 89 4 years ago. If you look at yourself today, and you were in a similar circumstance, what would that number be?
It would be a lot lower. And I immediately thought about, I lived with anxiety and depression all day, every day. I managed it very well. But I don't have either one of those anymore. And I'm knocking wood because, you know,
I'm with
those
you.
Are gone. Yeah.
So.
Those are gone. But. Yeah, well, you know, and
well,
then things come up
don't
in your
butt,
face.
Don't butt on it. But,
okay.
But just notice
All
that
right.
if it was an 89, it's now maybe a 40. That's a lot of, you know, after being around for 75 years and starting to do your work over a period of 4 years, when people say you should be going downhill, moving from an 89 to a 40, that's pretty phenomenal upgrade in your emotional system.
Right, it is. I totally agree. Why do you think I hang in here? I have to hear about propellers and this and that and newborn babies over and over because there's good stuff stuck in the middle here that is new all the time.
Right. So
I know you
have 4 years. If in 4 years you've gone from an 89 or whatever it might have been to a 40, what do you suppose it'll be in another four?
Well,
another
and I
four.
Want to be on the fast track. Right. I want to accelerate. But today I had two triggers, serious, disgusting triggers, where I wanted to strangle a person, trigger. You know,
Deep work.
A man who
Opportunity.
Yelled at me for having my dog off the leash in the park. We have a little cadre of people that early in the morning we let them run. And they're all good dogs, and he's screaming at us. And me, then, he picked me out because I had gone on ahead with my then leashed dog, and he was yelling at me. So I tried to engage him out of love. I held the loving space. I didn't hold it for very long, Michael. I wanted to cream him. He was just after my – it was just so obvious. What have I learned? I've learned about it, but I'm not doing it.
Well,
so anyway,
if you've gone from an 89 to a 40, you are doing it. You may not be doing it to the level of perfection that your perfectionism would like for it to be. So you might want to, in the process, become a retired perfectionist and be more self-accepting of where you are and what you're in, what your process is. You know, I can only say I've been seriously doing this work for a half a century. And I say this with total sincerity. I have done more important and deeper work in the last 2 years than I did in the whole first 48.
That's good.
And to me,
I've got to remember that.
Going to 90, going to 100, going to 150, going to 200 is an extremely exciting proposition that I talk to myself about all the time. It's like, I can't wait to be 300 years old and see what I comprehend, see what brain cells I have, see what understanding I have, and what kind of contribution I can make. To me, that's like one of the most exciting things possible.
Okay,
400,
Michael,
500, 2,000, 3,000.
All in this body, though? I mean, can't we get a new body and sort of reinvigorate ourselves? I don't think this body's going to hang in that long.
Well, but then let's remember that you didn't ever have a body, you're never going to have a body, and you don't have one now. Remember what a body is. A body is a construct in the mind. If you could look in a mirror and you could see, which with your eyes you don't see anyway, but if you could actually see what was standing in front of the mirror, you'd see this whirring mass of electrons, protons, neutrons, and light, and it's been burdened with carrying a genetic heritage that, you know, everybody over 120 in the bloodline's dead already, so it's been carrying quite a load, and that load is showing up and reflecting in what you look at in the mirror that you think of as your body. But the truth of it is, it's an eternal energy system. And the only reason that it has any infirmity, deformity, disease, suffering, weakness, or pain is because there are energetic patterns of that deformity, that weakness, that suffering, or that pain. And when you choose to come across them and forgive them, remove them from your structure, then the degraded reflection that you see will instantly shift and disappear. Because it's not what it appears to be. Remember, Yeshua said, don't judge by appearances. It's not what it appears to be. Now, listen to the lesson, and you might want to go back in this context with this conversation fresh. Jump on our YouTube channel and look at the video, What is the World?
And this
is a lesson from the Course. The world is false perception. Your body is a part of the world. It is false perception. It is born of error. It will remain in the degenerating state that it is now, no longer than the thought that made it that way is cherished. When I choose to give that up, then the structure has to change to correspond with the new, to reflect the new energetic pattern. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, and it's totally, totally blowing my mind. Yeah. The only thing I've been able to think is that I could reconstitute in some way so that I would have legs to walk on rather than, you know, parchment-thin old legs, 4,000 years old or whenever we're talking about, 2,000 years old. Anyway, so... yes, it does make sense, and I'm still too literal, and I'm taking it in as if I'm seeing what I'm really seeing in the mirror, and I'm not seeing it. Thanks for explaining that. That helps a lot to just give that other dimension. And I wondered about animals in the same. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I just sent you a link to What Is the World? Texted. If you just click on it and give it a listen, we finish the show, and then I also sent you a second text with the poem Love Restored, and really sit with that and like go through every thought and every idea in that Love Restored and recognize its truth.
Okay. Assignment accepted. So, Michael, then we have animals who are like little angels on the earth, and they also die. They don't look in the mirror and say, I'm getting old, but they do croak. So how do you fit that into there?
Well, if you take a look at the research, you'll see that animals die of the diseases their owners have, only they tend to die years before their owners do of the same diseases.
Wow.
The animal does not have volition. The animal cannot choose to engage in a particular vibration or energy. They're just there taking in whatever it is that is in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm conscious, I don't have to do that. Most humans live in the same realm as the animal. They're just, oh, well, whatever frequency's there runs them, they take it in, suck it in, and reflect it, play it out, and create according to it. We're the only creature we know of that can consciously choose or refuse to engage in a particular frequency. And when we refuse, then we change the game.
Wow, I've had a lot of pets and they've died of a lot of different things. So it's going to be very interesting to see what actually pans out. Oh, my God. That's such an interesting idea. And I can understand how that would be true. I've seen it expressed, like I have a friend who has an extremely anxious dog. Well, my friend is very anxious and her husband's very anxious. And this dog is living that life and picking up on it. I suppose that's what you mean, right? They just manifest what you're doing.
Exactly. I mean, look at how many people, you know, if you look at their dogs, they don't look at all like their dogs when they first get them, but you look at them 10 years later and the dog looks like the human and the human looks like the dog.
That too.
How often have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Too. Well, those are
so,
my main
so
questions.
Remember that we're continuously in a state of becoming.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not becoming according to love, our connection to love, and conscious choice, then we'll be going by whatever's programmed in the cell. And what's programmed in your cells and my cells is death. And what I say I'm committed to being eternal, I'm committed and I ask, I mean, just about every night before I go to sleep, my request of Rook is, show me what energies I'm ready to process that I am currently killing myself with. Teach me how to forgive those energetic patterns.
Oh, boy. Yeah. One of the parts of the worksheet that I like the most, because it stings the worst, is I give up my need or wish to be right.
Mm.
And that is
a huge one.
So that's just a comment neither here nor there. But in both cases with these triggers today, I wanted to be right worse than I wanted to care to hold the space of love. I ended up succumbing. It's just... It's true what you say.
And how does that look
bottom
like your generations?
Line. Well, I'll have to think about that because they weren't an angry bunch, really. I think I'm the maddest one of them all, actually. I don't know where I got that. But
interesting. So do you suppose it's possible, and this is just, you know, this probably doesn't mean anything, but it's just one of those offhanded comments.
Right. I know
it's
you,
possible
Michael. You're going to just shoot.
Do you think it's possible when you say, oh, they never had any of that, that your mind's in denial about what the people in your family system carried, and you think you didn't come by it honestly, you just made it up yourself?
Well, I can understand the logic of that, but I know my mother was violent with us when she was overwhelmed, but if she wasn't overwhelmed, she was loving, and she was a really loving overall.
Yep.
Here I am. I mean, I'm alive. And my dad...
Were you violent with your children?
I raised an arm to strike my toddler daughter and caught myself and said, oh, I've become my mother. I put my arm down. I remember telling you about that, and you said, I wonder how your daughter took in even seeing the raised arm. And I asked myself that. She's great, but, you know, she did. I was impatient. Sure, I was her power person. And
notice,
too.
And notice the advancement you made because you put your arm down.
That's true. Thank God.
How many times didn't your mother put her arm down? How many times didn't she?
Yeah, countless.
So that's a huge shift upward in one generation. But notice that your power person, your power person's voice is speaking through you, about you, as though it's you speaking. And I'd offer these messages about how I'm the worst one and I'm this and I'm that. They're just nothing but power person messages that were given to you. And they're lies. I mean, we just proved it's a lie.
And you know, Michael,
you perhaps raised
talking.
Your arm, but you never struck with it. And you mm-hmm. came from a bloodline that did strike over and over and over again quite viciously. And yet you defend her as, no, I'm the worst one. And that's a power person message to your heart. That's one to be forgiven.
Okay. Well, and you do say that. You said it several times when you were talking your talk this morning before I pressed one. You said forgiveness, it also includes us, ourselves. That seems to be just the last stand and the first base to hit both. Got to do that first.
Yes.
And that may be the hardest one to do, actually, in some ways. Not because of intellectual belief that I'm the worst, but it's so ingrained. It's just sitting in there. Yeah.
The lies
anyway,
we get trapped in.
Thanks for answering all those questions. Very helpful. I'm going to watch my animals and see what they do as they get old.
The light
Michael, they don't know what I mean.
And I've sent.
What,
go ahead, Jeannie.
There's a question in the chat room. What about animals like feral animals that don't have owners?
Oh, good question. Yeah.
Well, there's nothing we know of in the world that can stop the high energy wave that leaves the mind when we think a thought. Remember, you go back to the creation story and it talks about how we were given the power to name things and it was so. I offer that when we were given the power to originate mind energy for this world, and we were given dominion over it, we source the mind energy that kills everything.
Wow.
And it was not designed to be that way. It's my offering. Go back and read, and we're down to the last minute or so, but I'll just finish out. Go back and read some of the ancient accounts and the aboriginals and such. They don't talk about seeing dead bodies of animals and animals die. They talk about how, well, there was the animal and we could see it, and all of a sudden it just disappeared. They talk about how the animals transmuted and stepped up their vibration, not physically died. Who originated death? My offering is with man death began. That's exactly what the scriptures say. We made it up. And it's time for us to give it up. That's my take.
Thanks, Michael. That was a marathon.
Absolutely honored and delighted, young lady. Delighted. Good questions. Good clarity for all of us. Me too.